Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Writer's block again. Rich, could you help me out wherever you're? I'm having trouble writing. This is tough.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah.
Your life can end at any moment with just one glass of milk. Your parents' divorce is because of you. Do you really think your wife is going to stay with you your entire life?
No. I'm writing.
You're a podcaster. She's a doctor.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Tutor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
And you saw that goofball intro we did, but we're talking about a more serious topic today that encapsulates the tortured artist.
Yeah.
And you often see this. Van Gogh is one of the quintessential examples of this, where we're asking the question, do you need to be depressed to write? The reason we're asking that, just to have a conversation around that, is because oftentimes you hear about pain creates this masterful art. And the experiences and the trudge you go through, the depressive episodes and so forth, can do that. But then another question you have is, depression inherently at times debilitates some people. So why does depression and things related to that, we'll kind of talk about what we mean, because when people just say the word depression, what is that, right? And so depression or things that can mimic depression, why does that sometimes debilitate people and creatives? Why does sometimes it create art?
Yeah, I think it's also important to mention that we are inherently unserious people. If you don't look to us for actual clinical advice on anything regarded here. This was internet research of the DSM-5. We did not go to school for this. This is us talking about its relationship to writing. If you actually need help, seek professional help, not YouTubers.
Here's our ad by BetterHelp. No.
Oh, God, no. We're better than that.
I've heard very bad things about BetterHelp.
I have, too. There's a lot things. Of
controversy.
We will not take a BetterHelp sponsorship. That's for
or
sure.
Honey. You saw honey. The honey yes. controversy. Yeah. So a bunch of YouTubers, it was the biggest ad ever. And if anybody's seen what honey has done, they're scamming people.
I mean, there's the scam part, which is like they also scam the users too. I just find it funny that they actually scammed the YouTuber side of it mostly. And I just find that funny. Like
that's why you
scam.
See all the YouTubers complaining. They're like, whoa, 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 you can screw over people.
Yeah.
But my pockets? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So for this episode, as we're setting up this premise of do you have to be depressed to write, I guess starting off this whole tortured artist thing and depression, what do we mean by that in our very colloquial terms? And what are we talking about?
Well, I mean, if we want to break down like depression and just getting somewhere at the base level of what is depression, the DSM-5 currently states, and this is kind of a more fluid thing, but there's basically 7 classifications or types of depression, and I'm just going to rattle off real quick so we can get into discussion.
Let's do it.
First on the list is disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. It's typically that is the more minor level of depression. Severe recurrent temper outbursts manifest verbally or physically. There's a bunch of other lists. I'm not going to go through every single detail of it. Yep. Then there's the major depressive disorder. This is kind of your most severe version of depression. You have to have 5 or more of the following categories to be classified as having major depressive disorder. Depressed mood, diminished interest or pleasure, significant weight loss, insomnia or hypersomnia, psychomotor agitation.
I wish Nicole was here to help us.
I know. Yeah. Fatigue, nearly daily, feeling worthless / inappropriate guilt, diminished ability to think, and thoughts of death. So then there's also persistent depressive disorder, which is less severe but seems to be more of a longer stint, not actually as it's not as severe, but definitely lasts longer. Typically, it's depressed mood for most of the day for up to like 2 years. Like it's consistent more days than not for at least 2 years. Then there's premenstrual dysphoric disorder, not really applicable to what we're talking about today, but after childbirth and during childbirth and all that stuff. Then there's
postpartum depression.
Yeah, not childbirth. Yep. That's part of it. There's also menstrual cycle depression. Then there's also substance and medication-induced depressive disorders, which will be applicable what we're talking about today. Then there's basically relation to any other medical condition-induced depression. And then their last one is unspecified. Unspecified depression. Mm.
And that those last two cover a ton, because what you see some of the research we were doing here is bipolar is correlated with some form of creativity, and a symptom of bipolar. One of the things that comes with bipolar of amongst a bunch of things, depression can coexist with that. So all these other, go ahead.
Something clear to make out, a very common thread around depression, more common than not symptom of depression, is fatigue nearly daily and the diminished ability to be able to think. So those kind of symptoms themselves don't seem like they would relate to extreme creative outbursts.
Yes. I won't show this video, but David Lynch, who directed Mulholland Drive, one of my favorite films.
Great film.
It is 5 stars. Go watch that film. Phenomenal. David Lynch is a fantastic director. He talks a lot and gives speeches, talks about depression and how he attacks, and rightfully so, and like just his opinion of that whole tortured artist impression, and how when you have depression, you can't create. And he's talking about how it debilitates people, and he knows people with depression. This isn't something that just brings out these inspiration to them make this work of art, but depression often inhibits you creating something masterful or just creating anything in the first place. He's one of amongst a lot of people, but from that premise, then why do you think there is this stereotype out there of the tortured artist creating masterful work? And is depression and the tortured artist the same thing? We have to make sure we're talking about the same thing as well.
Sure. I think a lot of it, if you want to argue the other side, that depression, if you wanted to argue that depression leads to, you know, great creative works, it would not necessarily, because depression is not always like, it's not a constant where you feel it all the time, but you go through cycles and moods of it, that depressive episode can inspire a very creative idea or that you then, after that period of depression is over or after it subsides a little bit, then you actually create the work, but it's inspired from those episodes. Often where common, it typically is with, basically with depression.
By the way, you know, it's a serious episode when Rich has notes.
Like I actually wrote notes.
You saw him flip that page. I'm proud of you. God.
leads to a heightened sensitivity and awareness of aspects of life. So that episode of depression that could have you be hypersensitive and hyper aware of your life surroundings and things that you've experienced. Mm-hmm. After that's over, now you can talk about something with maybe a different point of view than if you weren't going through that episode. That's the argument for it. There's actually some studies that show both, like, overall tentative evidence, like, from what I saw, it's not really that conclusive for depression.
A lot of, I guess, just thinking about this logically, completely layman, you can often think, oh, the tortured artist, because you feel that amount of pain, you feel so deeply, and you have those really grim thoughts or loss of hope. Since, I guess you could say it's a lack of feeling too, but a deep, deep, deep sadness. And then when you experience that, and often you can create a work that expresses that so thoroughly and so accurately because you did experience it. Like a very not depressive example, someone that didn't have depression, but actually I wouldn't know, but Joe Abercrombie, very small example of this where he had severe back pain, real bad back pain, was able to create the character Glockta because he knew what bad back pain felt like. Mm-hmm. He's like, so when Glockta, every move, I think, entire character's entrenched in feeling every step is a pain and it's so focused, and why the character feels so real is, wow, I believe Glockta's in complete pain. And Joe Abercrombie also experienced that back pain. Probably not to Glockta's extent, because I think he went hard in the paint with Glockta's torture. But
yeah,
as a non-example, if you just experience something in life, you can usually write that in a provocative or just really deep way. So would you agree with that in general? If you experience something, maybe you can connect to it better.
Generally, people's experiences can lead to interesting creative works.
Which is why you don't have any works out there.
Exactly.
You have an uninteresting life.
Yeah, I work and then I come home and I read.
And he is very not depressed. He's happy doing that.
I'm doing just okie dokie.
See, that's the thing too, because when we ask the question, does depression, do you have to have depression? Can depression create masterful art? Yes, it can. But can
it,
not
it can inspire.
It can inspire. Can not having depression create masterful work? Yeah. Yes. Too.
All the time.
But the interesting part of that, I think, again, go into that first example, because we'll go through some authors who experienced depression and it debilitated them, and others who it did help create masterpieces. Mm-hmm. And starting with Van Gogh.
Before we hop into that, I wanted to say there was a study in 2012. So I was looking into it, and it was started really broad of basically people who are creative works, and it's linked to any kind of mental illness. So it went kind of broad. And they showed that there was only like a 8% for bipolar disorder. There was, for people who have bipolar disorder, there was an 8% increased chance of them going into a creative field, working into some creative field, which I guess it's something, but it's not huge.
Was that something of people that, was it chicken before the egg situation? No. Bipolar?
The likelihood, so people who have bipolar disorder have 8% increased likelihood of being in a more creative field.
Got it.
Now, take that a step further, and writers have a 121% higher likelihood than the general population to have bipolar disorder, according to this study, at least.
What study is this?
This is from, I got it off of Science Direct. There's a different journal. I'll have a link there below, but the title is called Mental Illness, Suicide, and Creativity, a 40-Year Perspective Total Population Study.
Wow.
Now,
129%, you said?
Also, okay. A 50% more, 50% higher likelihood than the general public to actually commit suicide.
Wow.
So, very interesting, I thought, but I would not take that as complete gospel. Like, there's other evidence to show that the link between creative works and mental illness is sort of weak. But I thought that was interesting, of the difference between like directors, dancers, actual painters, but writers specifically was a much higher likelihood.
Why do you think that is, if that is the case?
I'm not sure. So in addition to that, there was an older study, and it's related to a specific poet, Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
She's a very famous poet, and the psychologist named James C. Kaufman. Yeah. Kaufman. He basically coined the term the Sylvia Plath effect, which is correlating female poets have a higher likelihood of having bipolar disorder and any kind of mental illness, the highest likelihood group. So there's some evidence to that, but then he later on did work and published essays kind of countering his own work. So he has distanced himself from his own psychological effect term that he coined. But no, she is also a very famous poet that did kill herself.
Okay. And do you think you have something like bipolar and are more likely to become a writer, or you're a writer and does that develop? Or, I mean, because is it a chicken before the egg, where, again, with how bipolar works, genetic versus is it environmental? Because I wouldn't be the one to know. It's probably a mix of a lot of things. But what do you think? Is it just thinking with your common, not scientific, this is not us saying anything declarative, what would you say?
Sylvia Plath, in specific example, for when it comes to mental illness and depression, women in general, have a higher likelihood to experience depression than men. And then you go even further about, and then it's women, like poets. Poets overall apparently have a higher tendency for mental illness. So you just to stack in female artists, you're just putting yourself into another category of this group just has a higher likelihood of experiencing bipolar disorder.
Got it.
So I don't know if it's necessarily the career itself, but often there was talks about poetry as a means of coping.
Yep.
That it's a coping mechanism for these mental illnesses. Often something that people who experience bipolar disorder and also depression want to do is want to understand and want to connect with someone else, but also have a hard time doing so at the same time.
Yeah.
Writing is a way to get your feelings out and also try to be understood and connect with someone. So, possible way of coping.
Yeah, and I imagine too that can extend beyond depression to other mental illnesses as well. Because going on to why bipolar is being brought up a lot, there's this 2017 study I'll link below. You probably found this as well, where explored whether mood disorders cause creativity or creativity causes mood disorders or some unknown variable causes creativity and mood disorders. So they found that bipolar disorder, which is characterized by periods of mania and depression, was most often associated with creativity. In contrast, creativity was not associated with a persistent depressive disorder, PDD, also known as dysmythia, or low-grade depression. So again, that doesn't mean that's the only case, but it seems
like a common coping mechanism for people with bipolar disorder and also depression.
Yes.
That seems more of a likelihood than the other way around of people who are creative talents, develop it or anything. So it's probably mental illness leads to a coping mechanism of a creative outlet rather than the creative outlet causing depression.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd imagine too with who knows how this would exactly work in the grand scheme of things, because again, genetic variables, so forth, but in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, when your bottom needs are met of you have your survival, your house, physiological is the word I was looking over. Your physiological, your safety needs. And at the very top, once you get to the point of what is your self-fulfillment and your self-actualization at that top of the pyramid, where depression is probably different for different people and throughout time, where today, where we have all of our needs are met, our quote unquote like safety needs for people that are fortunate enough. So I'm assuming for people listening in, it's like, you have food,
house, large
amount of people today.
A large amount of people today compared to
In the past. So people are also living longer. So the brain is so fascinating to me because I know so little because my brain's small.
Yeah.
But then we also know so little about my small brain.
You know what's even funnier about that?
Yeah. It's funnier than my small brain?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not about the size of your brain. It's about how wrinkled it is.
Yeah.
It's why people say you have a smooth brain. The more wrinkles, the smarter.
Exactly. You got a really smooth head.
I got a smooth head.
But
wrinkly brain. Yeah.
So do we want to start with some examples?
Yeah.
I guess the first one I just want to toss out there was Van Gogh, because I think when people think of the tortured artist, we all learned Van Gogh in high school. And for those that don't know, he cut off his own ear. And there's that famous story. But with Van Gogh, he lived from 1853 to 1890. And we'll give writing examples after this. Just wanted to start with painter.
I have all of my examples are writers.
I have them after this too. So for Van Gogh, just to give this premise, they think that he had bipolar disorder, which goes with some of the studies we were finding too, where it says Van Gogh experienced manic and depressive episodes throughout his life. Manic episodes were characterized by euphoria, impulsiveness, reckless behavior, while depressive episodes included anger, social withdrawal, indecisiveness, and recurring thoughts of death and suicide. And there's proof of this, of just how he was feeling, because there's plenty of letters with Van Gogh. I'll say one of the letters, or a paragraph in one of his letters, where he wrote in 1888 to his brother Theo and explained, "I am unable to describe exactly what is the matter with me. Now and then there are horrible fits of anxiety, apparently without cause, or otherwise a feeling of emptiness and fatigue in the head. At times I have attacks of melancholy and of atrocious remorse." And so it's just this unexplainable feeling that he has, that he's explaining to his brother. And just to show what he actually did in his life, the life of Van Gogh, that you could watch whole videos on him, but this just gives a splice of an example.
A very awesome Doctor Who episode.
It's actually it's a great episode.
Yes, a good one.
The ending.
Oh, brings a tear to my eye.
It does.
Oh, God, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And so he, in a period of 70 days, Van Gogh produced some 75 paintings and over 100 sketches and drawings of this village that he was of, cornfields and forests surrounding it, within 70 days. So Van Gogh, it seems like, as a coping mechanism or what have you, he had bipolar depression. It's all was definitely had forms of depression. Well, and
that's one of the links is rather than depression, the reason why bipolar disorder is more associated with manic episodes. Mm-hmm. Manic episodes comes with a lot of energy. And so that often leads to very, like, if anything would be tied to create productive creative output, you would be experiencing very manic episodes.
Just zooming through, right?
So that would make sense if Van Gogh was experiencing an incredible amount or very long manic episodes, why he would create a bunch of works.
Yeah, and just something that is probably why you hear the Van Gogh tortured artist thing. So that is the Van Gogh story. Now getting more into our field of writing, did you have an example of a writer you wanted to bring up?
Sure.
And whether this was, it did help them or not.
Yeah, so help them? I don't know.
Did it create a masterpiece or were they unable to write?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I think the first example that a lot of people think about with famous authors would be Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
So Ernest Hemingway, very, very famous author. I always hear on YouTube, like, the whole thing, you're not supposed to say suicide. What is that?
Like, say the word suicide?
Yeah. You're not supposed to say that word on YouTube?
I think that's TikTok or something. I'm not sure.
Oh.
But if they flag us for that, we'll know. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whatever. Anyway, he killed himself on July 2nd, 1961. And short of his life, he suffered through great periods of depression throughout all of his life, a lot of it due to family trauma. One of the things that also sent him kind of spiraling was he was also addicted to alcohol. So had substance abuse problems, problems with the women in his life, and in addition, so a lot, he had a lot of trauma from his mother and how his mother treated him, and ultimately led to a great distrust of women, which messed up almost every relationship going forward. He then went through a great period of depression or sadness when his father committed suicide, and he even lamented in a letter to someone saying, to his then mother-in-law, that he expects he'll probably go out the same way as his father. So he's thinking that for a long time. But if you want, like, a direct reference of his depression and how he was experiencing things, and that relating to his works, arguably Hemingway's best work, or at least most famous, is For Whom the Bell Tolls, where the main character's father actually commit suicide in basically the exact same way as Hemingway's father. And so a direct relation of his masterwork to a big source of his depression.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that Hemingway couldn't write things without depression really leading on? I would say no. But it clearly was an inspiration for one of his greatest works.
I do feel like that is a with something so awful and dire, so having depression, so a light or positive way to look at it is if that depression did lead to him creating a work like that. And it, I guess from the person who wrote it, their point of view, obviously the depression isn't going to make you feel this way. But if depression is able to make a masterpiece or allow you to create something that other people love and connect to, and you found some, you did something productive with your mental illness, or it felt like you did, because a lot of times if it's debilitating, you could feel even worse, go on more cycles of rumination and et cetera. But if it creates something that people end up loving, and you, even if you don't feel proud, even if you don't feel like you've accomplished that thing, is there some sort of beauty in that, that something so awful can create something good?
Again, it depends on the person and what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Often everyone wants to be understood and wants to be, they don't want to feel alone. Like the way they're looking at the world is unique. They want to know that other people also see the world the same way they do, or at least sometimes can at least understand them. And for how popular the book was, For Whom the Bell Tolled touched a lot of people's hearts. And I imagine that is incredibly touching.
Yep.
For Hemingway himself. But then again, it isn't enough. I don't know. But it's certainly a special perspective of, at least, like, I know I have never experienced depression that bad. Like, I've been sad before, but I would never say I've experienced true depression.
Mm-hmm.
But when you read something like this, you can at least experience or attempt to view a perspective that you haven't had before.
Right.
Which I think is special. It's a special thing for humans to do. And that is most writing. Most great, unique works is experiencing a point of view you didn't think you quite literally could ever before.
That's why we love fantasy sci-fi, because getting a perspective from an animal or from a gadget, from an alien, from a robot.
From a spider.
Yeah. Children of Time. Fantastic. So yeah, with Hemingway's situation, then it seems like that is a case where his depression was able to create a book.
Well, it also, it wouldn't be completely fair to say that it was the sole inspiration. There's of course his life during World War II was also incredibly impactful. And just because part of the book is inspired, I think, pretty clearly by his own father's suicide and the depression that followed Hemingway after that, doesn't mean that the entire book is that. And I think it would be unfair to clarify that. I just think it's one of many parts of inspiration.
Yes. And that's part of it too, because when you're given a blanket statement for this is the reason they were able to create this, well, Hemingway in the first place, if he wasn't a great writer who didn't have the skills to be a writer, and all of that has to be there in the first place too. So you have to be able to tell a story as well.
Yeah.
So I have an example with one of our favorites, Susanna Clarke.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Do we have Pierre Nessie back here?
All unorganized.
How dare you?
There's somewhere.
Pierre Nessie, Clark wrote this, and her debut novel was Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Sold over 4 million copies. We have not read it yet.
I got it on my shelf.
We really should read it. It's a long book. Oh, there she is. That's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell right there.
Yeah.
So she wrote that book back in the early 2000s. I believe it was 2004. And she then, after publishing that very successful debut novel, didn't write another novel for 16 years. The next one she published really was Pierre Nessie in 2020. And so I'll read this off of this article where Susanna Clarke was interviewed. Says, what Pierre Nessie, it's not the long-awaited sequel for Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, but only months after the publication of her debut, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, Clarke became ill with what eventually was diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome. So before I continue with this article, point about this being, when we're talking about this pain, the tortured artist, depression is one of those aspects, but other things like this chronic fatigue syndrome or the endless list of other things that you could mentally be going through. So just an example here where it's not exactly depression. Mm-hmm. And because depression can debilitate, this is a situation where chronic fatigue syndrome debilitated Susanna Clark. I'll explain here. So Clark says, I was doing a lot of traveling and promoting and getting on and off airplanes, the sort of things I'd never done before. And then in the spring of 2005, I collapsed, and that was the beginning of it. It's hard to remember an illness because it's just a lot of nothing. It's very hard to make it into a shape. So that's her explaining what happened right after this big release and huge success. Right afterwards, she gets this huge fatigue where she can't write. And this is how she explains it. She says that her writing became torturous. All the projects I've tried to work on while I was ill kept flowing down a lot of alleys. That was part of the illness. And she said that the sequel to Jonathan Strange, Mr. Norrell, is still long off. She couldn't work on it for some reason. What she found was, I think it may be a feature with chronic fatigue that you become incapable of making decisions. I found it impossible to decide between one version of a sentence and another version, but also between having the plot go in this direction and having it go in that direction. Everything became like uncontained bushes shooting out in all directions. That's the state of the sequel to Jonathan Strange. It's almost like a forest now. And so she felt like it went in that many directions. She really couldn't work on it. It felt like it was too much to her. And the reason she ended up writing Piranesi, a novella, is she found that Piranesi, the novella, was a lot more manageable for her to do. Because Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, as she described, she was saying how Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell had so many different characters and plot, and it is a massive book and a big arduous task. And she had to do so many plot threads, so many characters. But Piranesi was from one viewpoint character, and she felt like she didn't have to go in those endless directions of where the plot and character could go. She was a lot more focused and able to handle a novella with her chronic fatigue syndrome. And so for her, it was simplifying what book she could write. And on top of that, she experienced years of isolation and illness before COVID hit. And so she was kind of locked up, or not locked up, literally in her own home, but unable to go around. And she was very much living a life that also inspired, I won't spoil for anybody, but Piranesi is a fantastic masterpiece of a novel about this character Piranesi living in this fantasy world, dreamlike, enchanting world with statues and awesomeness. And there's a lot of deep, incredible messages in there. So people go read Piranesi. But
also incredible isolation.
And incredible isolation. Yeah. So that is Susanna Clark's perspective of how it was debilitating for her, and she found a way to write a novel that worked with her illness that created what I think is a masterpiece of a novel.
Yeah, and I agree with you.
It'll be a classic one day, I think. But anyways, what do you think about her story and just what that means for this topic?
I think Piranesi is such a unique perspective of a story, especially with its ending. I'm not going to give any spoilers away for it at all. But when we had our book club discussion,
yeah,
which linked down below if you want to join us for book clubs, it's a cool group, it's fun.
It's awesome, yeah.
Go look it up on Patreon and all that. I thought I understood that story.
Yeah.
And I thought I understood its perspective and what the message was trying to say.
Yeah.
And then almost every single person in the Discord call had a different perspective on what the message was, even like whether it was real or not.
Oh, don't give too many spoilers, but yeah.
But like, what's going on? Like, no one knew. And that was so cool. And it wasn't that it was confusing and so people didn't know what was going on. It was just, you could interpret it in so many different ways that were all, I think, very equally valid.
Mm-hmm. Very ambiguous. But beyond that,
it still had charm.
Ooh.
It wasn't ambiguous and just kind of gray. I thought it was fairly hopeful and fairly positive overall as a book, which I think that's a really fun perspective. Such a depressive, isolating world, it could have been incredibly tragic and sad, but I thought it was very hopeful and positive.
So much so that the two things that inspired this episode in the first place are, one, Rachel, our buddy Caleb, an admin on our Discord, and so Salty, he's known Salty on there, but Caleb his wife, Rachel, we were on the Salt Lake trip in Dragonsteel. We were driving in the car and she just asked the question like, hey, what depression and writing and creating RP? She's an artist and I won't say anything, but I don't know what she wants on the internet. So I'll just say she's an artist and she was asking that question in the car. And I said, I'm going to write that down. And so that's how we came up with this video idea. Thank you, Rachel. And then secondly, the first thing I connected with that was knowing that we reviewed Pierre Nessy and this story about Susanna Clark. Mm-hmm. And so she's the prime example for me of why I guess this tortured artist having this chronic fatigue syndrome prevented her from making a lot of books.
Yeah. It
prevented her from the sequel of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. She could have, if she didn't suffer this, might have been able to write other masterpieces in that time we won't know in an alternative universe. Well, however, yeah.
To get that kind of more specific, mm-hmm. that the difference between a major depressive disorder often is not as long lasting. Like it's not a state that typically people are in for great extended periods of time. Mm. It's very intense and very specific time-wise. And you go in and out of it, but right. It's not long-lasting. But that is such a deep, intensive emotion that once you're out of it, then maybe you can actually be great. But like, no, I highly doubt anyone going through like major depressive disorder in the thick of it would have the ability to even write anything at all.
Yep.
But that can still be that well of emotion and that experience that you can tap into. But things like persistent depressive disorder is a lot longer, like can last for years. And I imagine that maybe something similar with Susanna Clark, of it lasts for years and can't get out of it, and that it just drains you of all energy.
And for her, who knows what would have been written there. But mm-hmm. with having chronic fatigue syndrome, she was then able to create a masterpiece that we wouldn't most likely would have not have gotten otherwise.
Yeah.
And so it's a case where who knows what would have been, but it look at Pierre mm-hmm. Nessy now. So yeah. it's neat to see why it gets so romanticized, that tortured artist able to create from this pain, create something good. Because it's something I think emotionally, even when I'm reading stories and you have a bittersweet ending. Mm-hmm. I love bittersweet endings. I love a bittersweet feeling because yes, there's something objectively bad and that can't be fixed and that is bad. But then you're able to find some sort of light in an otherwise dark meaning, a dark scenario. Mm-hmm. So that I always love to get that out of it. But for you, I have another example that might tackle onto that, but I want to give you a chance because you have another example after Hemingway. Yeah.
I have plenty.
Yes.
But one in particular that I pulled it from my memory. It was the first thing I thought of because this is like a core memory of mine from English class.
Yeah.
Set the scene. So.
Oh, we're getting like a little lore from
getting a little
Richie down in the.
Dropping a little Richard lore here. Okay. So J.D. Salinger, most famous for The Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
I'll talk about his story a little bit because a couple details on it is mind-bogglingly fascinating. But beyond that, after reading The Catcher in the Rye, we were reading a short story by him for English class. And we're supposed to read it in class together. It's a fairly short story. And the story is called A Perfect Day for a Banana Fish.
Mm.
The story
said, don't you hate this book?
No.
I thought you hate it.
It's hard to hate this short story in the sense of I find it wild.
Okay, is what you'd
think
say
about of how
it.
This has impacted me. Yeah. Of just, I find it crazy. It's an insane story. Which actually, that's mean to say. And specifically, I'll get to
what's mean.
That's not fair to Mr. Salinger. Because that's related to later. I'll talk about him. That whatever.
Okay.
Story time.
Okay.
A perfect day for a banana fish. A man is on vacation. He's at the hotel pool. And little girl comes up to him. They begin talking. And he begins to tell her the story of like what are he says it's a perfect day for a banana fish. And she's like, well, what's a banana fish? He says, well, banana fish is a lot like a bunch of other fish. But this fish likes to eat bananas. what they'll do is they will at some coast, they will swim at high tide. They'll swim into a cove and into these little pools where bananas have fallen into these little pools, and then they'll eat bananas. And she goes, "Oh, well, what happens to the banana fish?" Well, I'm sorry to say it, but after they eat all of these bananas, they get so big that by the time high tide comes again, they can't escape the cove. And she asks, "Well, what happens to them if they can't escape?" He says, "Well, they die." She goes, "Oh, that's sad." He's like, "Yeah, it is." And so then he walks up to his hotel bedroom, yells at someone in the elevator for staring at his feet, because he thinks he has very respectable feet and they shouldn't be stared at. Goes into his room, looks at the woman in the twin bed across from him, goes into his luggage, pulls out a gun, and shoots himself in the head. That's the story of A Perfect Day for a Banana Fish. And I'm sitting there going, what the fuck is this? Just, what is this story? Is it just, it hits you out of nowhere. It's the last paragraph of him just like going up to his room and then just pulls out the gun and shoots himself. That's it.
So I'm reading here. Here's what the meaning of it. The story tells about a fish. It's a metaphor for the destruction caused by war and hyper-materialistic culture.
I get it. I understand. But me and my tiny brain.
I was just so curious because I had no idea what that... Well, because there's probably more in the story. There's a lot more in the story.
Like connects
to war and so forth.
Yes.
Okay.
To give details...
I like your explanation because that's such a curveball.
I know.
Yeah. I know the ending because you've said the story, but it's still...
To little young Richard, that came out of fucking nowhere. What is this?
Yeah.
So, beyond that, J.D. Salinger is actually really interesting, where I did not know this. When he was a soldier in World War II, and he landed on D-Day.
Wow.
And you know what he had in his pocket as kind of a token, a memento?
What?
6 chapters of Catcher in the Rye. He carried 6 chapters in his pocket while he landed on D-Day as kind of a token. And he continued writing that book through the war. And then when he released it.
Dang.
Now, the reason why I said it's mean to say it was crazy. There was a more interesting example when he released Catcher in the Rye, when he was trying to get it published. One of the publishers basically said, Holden, the main character, is crazy. And the main character to him was him. He put a lot of himself into the main character. And this coming from after the war, he went immediately into a mental institution directly after the war. And when he checked out, one of the interesting things is he went right back into the war for the denazification of Germany.
Wow.
Wild that you like. In the mental hospital, then as soon as you get out, back to... Actually, it's not that...
Uncommon.
Uncommon.
Yeah.
But still, after all this, he tries to publish his book, and the publisher basically says, Holden's crazy, and therefore, he's crazy. And he cried, and it was such a painful thing of, after getting out of the mental institution, after going through war, him being called crazy again was not... painful thing for him to call it, because he was really deeply uncomfortable with how people would see him through his book and how people would view him after releasing it.
Wow.
So that's why I say mean to call his story and him crazy. But I thought it was wild when I was younger.
Wow.
Yeah. Go ahead. Read A Perfect Day for a Banana Fish.
And Pure Nessie. That's our recommendations of this episode so far. Oh, you're going to get more. Because I got plenty. With that example, not exactly that Seymour, but take any other writer who has been in a war. So World War I and J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis as well. He was in World War I, I believe. But J.R.R. Tolkien was in the Battle of the Somme, one of the deadliest battles in World War I, on the Western Front. Sorry. Yeah, Battle of the Somme, I think. But J.R.R. Tolkien, and you can look at a lot of his fight scenes and in Helm's Deep and just perspectives and going through the marsh, the marshes. And a lot of those scenes people will look at and go, did he get that from his experience in the war? So not necessarily like who knows what was in J.R.R. Tolkien's psyche, but even going through something like that, then being able to write about it evocatively because you experienced it. Just another example of war can do that. And I guess today's writers, for U.S. centric as well, today's writers, the most recent big war being the Iraq War, and before that, Vietnam, if we're talking in that phase.
Big, more...
Grand scale.
Aggressive wars, probably that.
Probably those, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but Desert Storm was, I think, done in a week.
Yeah, I'm just talking like the a lot of people that you know and that are veterans from these wars, etc. Yeah. But you can look at that and then see culture also changes over time, but you can see how books are and different modern writing is impacted by culture, the wars that are going on. And obviously writers coming out of World War II wrote certain kind of books, and then writers more recently write certain kind of books, not that it's all directed the war and so forth. Mm-hmm. But also interesting to see just what happens as warfare expands and as different experiences do. Like you have PTSD, and we understand more about that. Anyways, back to your point with Seymour.
J.D. Salinger.
Oh, it wasn't Philip Seymour?
No.
I said
J.D. Salinger.
Why did I think Seymour?
I don't know.
Did you say Seymour at one point?
No, I did not.
You said Seymour.
I didn't say Seymour.
You said Feed Me Sorry Seymour Banana Fish, and then it was there.
I didn't.
No, okay. You probably didn't. Yeah. but the point with that is, so he did he have depression, like clinical depression as well? Or
yeah.
Definitely did, yeah.
Depression, anxiety, I believe. That there was not too much of confirmation. The more confirmed thing is like depression and intense anxiety.
Yep.
It would be unfair to posthumously diagnose someone. So it's loose. A loose definition of anxiety is more clear. Depression, yes. But like bipolar disorder, I wouldn't know.
That's always a tough thing too, because there's a lot of guesswork.
Yeah.
And so I have an example where there's zero guesswork.
Oh, okay.
It's depression's the best. No, it's like, so
the bee's knees.
The bee's knees. I don't know if it's right behind me. Where did it go?
What are you looking for?
Sordekaigen.
Oh,
it was right there.
We were probably using it for an example somewhere.
We were. Okay, but the Sordekaigen.
I really need to organize my bookshelves.
But ML Wang, why I bring this up, one of my favorite books ever, if you've been watching this channel, The Sordekaigen. Why I bring that up is Emma Wang is very clear that she was going through depression at the time of writing that book. I just blatantly can say this here. She was asked a question on the Fantasy Book Critic, and they said, hey, without spoiling things, The Sordekaigen seems ripe for a sequel, while at the same time telling such a complete story that it could easily stand on its own. Is that your plan? Is this a trilogy or is it a series? How far have you planned? Because they're curious, how far are we right into the series? And Emma Wang says, The Sordekaigen will never have a direct sequel for a few reasons. First, I was very depressed when I wrote it, and I'm glad the experience is behind me. So there's no other way to look around it than she was definitely experiencing the depression. And The Sordekaigen, to me, is tear-jerking. The characters are insane. It's one of the most emotionally gripping stories I've read, and it's a huge example to me for how somebody going through something bad can create a piece of work that makes others feel so deeply, and that she, although she was going through depression, would never want to go through it again. She's glad it's behind her. She was able to create this masterpiece out of it. Mm-hmm. And didn't debilitate her from writing that. So it's just interesting to see how it works for Emma Wang. And yeah. I would be curious if I would hope we could talk to her one day. And even if she's comfortable enough to be asked questions about that, she doesn't interview. She doesn't like to be interviewed on video and so forth. Mm-hmm. But if we ever got to talk with her like that, that would be a great person to ask with how did that work exactly? Because we're doing a lot of guesswork.
We could maybe try and do a written form interview.
Yeah.
A lot of publishers do that kind of stuff. Maybe we could try that.
Yeah. Well, I guess that very clear example of she did have that. And this was back in 2020 after she wrote Sordekaigen. I think that came out 2019. She even had a post where she talked about mental health and productivity goals, where she doesn't like to talk about how she handles her anxiety, depression so much at all. but she wanted to kind of set goals for the new year and was kind of being more open, like, hey, here's what I want to do. And she referenced things about giving more to charity, spending less time on social media, tracking her workout. Anyway, just talking about how she doesn't like to talk about it, but talks about ways she can handle it and ways to make it better and potentially cope. And I wonder if writing is a way. I can imagine that is a big way that she handles her depression.
Could be.
Guessing from what's been said so far. But that to me is, again, an incredible thing that comes out of something awful. So
yeah. You want to end it on a real bummer?
I mean, you could just, whatever you say is going to be a bummer generally.
That's true.
Yeah. So let's end it on a bummer.
I've been fascinated by this.
You're saying
the
episode on depression isn't a bummer. Like, we're usually goofballs here.
We could try and end it on a positive note, but I've been wanting to, this is a story that I've been just very fascinated with.
Tell me.
If anyone hears something that I'll ask for, if you happen to have an extra copy of this book, please send it my way. I've been looking around. It's one of those things I just want to have to try. I like, feel like it's a piece of history and I'm curious to try it.
P.O. Box is in the description below.
Okay. Yes. Stephen King. Stephen King is pretty famous for his substance abuse and how he's gotten over it. He is now sober. Awesome for him. But through his time of suffering substance abuse and also basically depression after a very serious automobile accident, which he thought that he was never going to be able to walk again, and all these different experiences. He wrote a book under his pseudonym, Richard Bachman, I believe, called Rage. This is not necessarily related specifically to Stephen King, but it's more of what his book had in like some degree of influence over.
Yeah.
Because after that book was released, there is somewhere between 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I think about 6 or 7. Six or seven incidents of school shootings that were directly related to this book.
Was it 6 or 7?
Yeah. Wow. It's a lot. So basically this book is written from perspective of a school shooter that's holding up his classroom at gunpoint. And after this book was released, so the first one, basically the person copied basically what was in the book, and from his stuff and other students said, like, he read this book over and over and over again.
Holy crap.
And he really deeply connected to it. And he felt like the, you know, author understood him. And so he emulated the actions of that book. Several other, like,
wow.
He got up to 8. I think he pulled the book after, like, the second attempt. Like, someone also did another school shooting where they found this book in their locker. And so after that second attempt, he pulled the book from publication, but continued on, where I think it's a total of about 8. Eight different school shooting incidents that kind of directly related to it. It's not that, don't misinterpret me at all, of Stephen King bears no responsibility at all for these school shootings. It is not his fault. It is their fault.
It's the school shooter.
It is not that he inspired it. But the point I'm trying to make is people that would commit a school shooting, that this book connected with them. And they felt understood by it. Like, there's a deep mental and, like, emotional connection that this book made to these people. And I find that just incredibly fascinating, where I'm like, I gotta know. It seems like this book really nailed this perspective of something I can never imagine myself ever being in. And that's part of the point of books, is being able to experience or at least view a perspective that you would never have in your own life. And the fact that it was so connected to all these different school shootings, I am morbidly fascinated by this book.
So when you said
I want to read it.
You said in the past, I didn't know the number was that high, because you told me that fact in the past. But when you said this episode was ending on a bummer, wow, you exceeded expectations.
That is the
bummers of all bummers.
I tried to exceed expectations.
That's the saddest way to end an episode.
I know.
Wow. But
he beat his addiction.
Stephen King?
Yeah.
Did his work suffer from that?
I've heard
post beating addiction Stephen King is worse than addiction Stephen King. Going to the tortured artist.
Yeah.
when you're going through something, whether it's substance abuse, addiction, depression, does it create better art? Sometimes yes. But if you don't have those things, you can also create masterpieces. So what did we learn today, Rich?
Basically, bipolar disorder seems to be more linked to creative works than depression.
They could have stopped pretty early on. We said that.
Yeah.
Pretty early on.
I think that's kind of what we learned.
Honestly, it was neat to look at. I didn't look into the people you saw there. So that was pretty neat.
I still have the guy Seymour,
you did say Seymour earlier, of course.
Yeah. But I now feel like you. I have extra notes that we didn't even get to. That's wonderful.
Isn't it neat?
I feel prepared.
Now, personal feelings, are you like, damn it, I wish we got to it? Or do you feel satisfied?
Satisfied.
Good. I'm happy.
I don't need to talk.
I would hope you wanted to go on and I would have cut us off. It would have been a whole bit. You didn't love me the one.
I didn't do it.
So we'll just have a normal ending for this one. Thanks for tuning in.
Hopefully Austin won't just chug a big gallon of milk after this episode. So
yeah,
I'll hold him back.
All right. Bye everybody. We'll see you next week.
Bye everyone.
Taxes was waiting around for your taxes to be done, which led to worrying about not getting any money back. Now Taxes is matching with a TurboTax expert who can do your taxes in a day to get you up to $4,000 fast with a refund advance loan. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Expert filing only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Refund advance has $0 loan fees and 0% APR. Refund advance loans may be issued by First Century Bank, N.A. or Web Bank. Terms apply, subject to approval.